Hello and welcome to another episode of Election Watch. We're back again bringing you the best of Expression FM news and politics unboxed. So have no fear, the A-team is here.
Election Watch.
Joining me today is Vicky and also Callum, who people will have remembered from every single show we ever did on Expression FM News alongside Vicky, and a couple of Politics Unboxed late night stopovers that I got him roped into. Not quite sure how Callum felt about staying on for some of the conversations, but I'm sure we had some fun going slightly insane between the hours of 9 and 11 p.m. in the studio, didn't we, Callum?
I was gonna say going.
But I thought you were gonna try and quibble with the word slightly, but
I mean, anyway. Everyone knows that's just an outright kind of
no outright lies on this one. Anyway, it's just sugarcoating the truth. We are gonna start with some things that definitely can't be sugarcoated for the government, because, well, it's what, just over a week now since the Tiverton, Honiton and Wakefield by-elections, as we all sit in separate places recording this. And it is fair to say that the government did not have a good Thursday night into Friday morning. Two seats they went into defending, two seats that both the MPs resigned from in, shall we say, dubious circumstances for one and outright criminal circumstances for the other. And they've lost both of them, one to the Liberal Democrats and one to the Labour Party, both sort of strengthening their grip on areas that you might suggest historically had been traditional bases for both of those parties. The Liberal Democrats taking a seat in the southwest, which I can remember looking back on electoral maps and thinking, well, there's quite a lot of old gold on that. And then suddenly 2015 came around and it was all gone. And the Labour Party taking a former red wall seat, hoping to put another brick in that wall. I'm just going to quickly run through the official results from those seats, and then we'll open it up to our fabulous contributors to talk about what this means. In Tiverton and Honiton, the MP elected is Richard Ford, who got 22,537 votes, beating Helen Herford of the Conservative Party, 16,393. Only two other people breaking the 1,000 vote mark. The Green Party with 1,064, Gillian Westcott, and Gwendolyn Pohl for the Labour Party on 1,562. Smattering of other candidates there. A decent size majority on a quite good turnout for a by-election, to be brutally honest. 52% is good. And to overturn a 24,000 Conservative majority to end up with over 6,000 in a majority is very good going for the Liberal Democrats. In terms of Wakefield, well, it is a result that is very, very good for the Labour Party. They have won back that seat. Wakefield goes red. And it's not exactly close, because the by-election followed what many people were predicting. It was a resounding victory for Simon Lightwood of the Labour Party, with just under 50% of the vote, 13,166 votes for him. Not particularly close was Nadeem Ahmed of the Conservative Party, 8,241 votes, 30% of the vote, and a smattering of other parties and independents getting seats. Lower turnout there, 39.5%, but still a real kick in the teeth for the Conservative Party. So, turning to my wonderful, wonderful co-contributors on this podcast, and I don't know who wants to jump in first and say something here, but what's the overarching, the big picture narrative that we can get from these two by-elections before we start to dive into specifics for the government and for the opposition parties?
I mean, if I go first, it's, I mean, yeah, not great for the Conservative Party. I think, I mean, it's, I wouldn't say it's like amazing for the Labour Party. It's kind of neutral. It's where they need to at least be to be in contendence to win. They need to be winning places like Wakefield to be at least kind of on the right track to getting anywhere near the government's next election. I think it's even better news for the Liberal Democrats, who kind of can now can see a path to do something and actually make a difference. And I'm sure we'll talk more about it, but it makes it look like they've actually got a path to being prominent or in a coalition. And so I think worst news for the Conservatives, kind of middling for Labour, very good for the Lib Dems.
Yeah, it's definitely the... it's a great game for the Lib Dems, certainly, to kind of rebuild their... place in the southwest by all means, and certainly it's not a bad thing for Labour. I'd agree with Vicky's assessment that like the ones who've lost out the most is Conservatives in this case. But it should be noted as well that in both elections, while some of it is due to a lower turnout, as by-elections tend to have, the majorities by which these were won are smaller than the majorities which were won in majorities of the last general election. The Conservatives won by, that was word salad, I apologise.
No, don't worry at all. It's actually quite an important point to mention, because let's just take Tiverton and Honiton, for example, something that you two have both agreed is a brilliant victory for the Liberal Democrats. And I'm fully in lockstep with that. It's a fantastic gain that even at the start of the by-election campaign, we're being brutally honest, some people just didn't think was going to happen. They thought it was going to be close for the Liberal Democrats, but they weren't going to be able to overturn that majority. The Liberal Democrats come out of that with just shy of 23,000 votes total. Neil Parish, the former MP, back at the 2019 general election, had a majority of 24,000 votes. So if you look at that, then you can start to put a bit of a cloud hanging over that particular by-election. Although, in other news, looking at the swing in terms of percentages, because even in a by-election where there's lower turnout, the people who don't vote, they don't vote. We can essentially cast them aside, at least in part, for political analysis. That swing is phenomenal. It is the biggest post-1945 swing against the Conservative Party in a by-election. It is absolutely massive, I think, in terms of records that the Liberal Democrats have been able to put. It's certainly the biggest swing that the Liberal Party or the Liberal Democrats have ever had since 1922, which is just quite simply astounding to see. As far as Wakefield goes, I think you're right again there, both Vicky and Callum. It's a seat that Labour Party have to win to get back into power, you would imagine. There isn't really a path to power through Tony Blair's Middle England route without having the red wall to put some foundations underneath it, especially with the situation in Scotland. Scotland that so often was this bastion of Labour support. It's been the bedrock of every single Labour government, Scottish support. With no Scotland, Labour has to have the red wall in order to build on and to create an actionable majority in Parliament. So I think, absolutely, horrible night for the Conservatives, middle-ish night for the Labour Party, great night for the Liberal Democrats, but there are some major caveats hanging over the heads of all three parties, being brutally honest.
I mean, yeah, I completely agree with that analysis, but low voter turnout and people not wanting to vote for the Conservatives isn't something the Conservatives should kind of be resting on and going, oh, well, they only won because people didn't turn out to vote for us. People who were who would normally be Conservatives, who would vote Conservative in every election, not bothering to go out and vote in a by-election that was going to be close, that there was so much talk about in the media and so much attention on their home areas. isn't good for the Conservatives. I mean, it still doesn't show. I mean, they could rest on it by saying, oh, maybe it means in a general election campaign with high voter turnout, we can make it closer. But they've still got to remedy a position of people not wanting to vote for them because they could still stay at home during a general election.
Yeah. I mean, voter apathy is one of the most detrimental things for any political party, regardless of whether they're kind of in government or if they're one of the opposition parties. The fact that people, like the idea of something being the status quo, like there's been so many votes, both in election terms and even down to the EU referendum back in 2016, where people were just assuming it's a status quo, it'll be fine, I don't need to vote. And then coming across with significant changes, essentially. So it's an interesting one. Like, in response to the win in Tiverton and Honiton, it's quite important to note, like, a response from Sir Ed Davey, Liberal Democrat leader, and it speaks to some of the things we mentioned as well, where he was saying it wasn't just about Partygate or, to quote him, constant lies. It was just a sense of neglect and being taken for granted by the Conservatives. And I think there is certainly a lot to be said about things being taken for granted with these results.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, something that we've talked about ad infinitum on Expression FM News and to an extent on Politics Unboxed is Partygate and the various scandals that are miring the Conservative Party at the moment. I know people always talk about 1997 when they're talking about historic Conservative defeats. Are we looking at a train of by-elections that you think are similar to the lead-up to 1997 in terms of what they're about? There's a general sense in a lot of the mainstream media and being paraded around by almost all the opposition parties that the Conservative Party is a party of sleaze. It's a nasty party again. We're seeing very similar themes coming forward. First off, is my talk of 1997 helping anyone at all, least of all Keir Starmer, perhaps? But also, is it potentially something the Conservatives can look at and think, well, hang on, how can we possibly avoid this? This has got to be something far much worse than just midterm blues in a by-election, which do tend to go against the government and has been the line parroted by the Conservative Party.
I mean, it's difficult to, I think there's two problems with the comparison to 1997. One is it's difficult to know how short-term/long-term this kind of apathy of the Conservative Party is. They've been in power for ages. Things are not good at the moment. We don't know if the economic situation will be better by the next election. And whether people could kind of overlook sleaze and lies to vote for the economy or how they perceive the best party for the economy means it might not all be doom and gloom for the Conservative next election. But I think also I think as a country, we're a bit more tribal than we were in 1997. So I think the possibility of there being a complete landslide in one direction is just so much more minimal now, because you're always going to have a group of people who can never see themselves voting Labour, and you're always going to have a group of people who can never see themselves voting Conservative. And I think it's going to take much more this time to get as big a swing of results, because people are just so dug into their own media ecosystems, they're so dug into their own party alliances, that big shift can't happen.
But even within that as well, it's going to be interesting to see, because we've spoken ad nauseum on various news shows about how polarized stuff has gotten over the last while. Certainly, I know that there's been a fair few discussions in that regard, but yeah, it's going to be interesting, because alongside that idea of, yeah, people are seeing themselves as never being able to vote for Conservatives, of never being able to vote for Labour, there's also that kind of inner party conflict, certainly. Like, recently we've seen, obviously, with primarily through from Labour is getting a lot of coverage, and especially surrounding the kind of Starmer position on the recent rail strikes and various union actions as well. And that is, and there have been those voices who have been involved with the Labour Party who are vehemently disagreeing with that. So we are seeing kind of not only just a case of, you know, tribalism between parties, but tribalism within the parties as well. So that could, in the long run, be to the detriment of the major parties as people try to look for options which better suit their particular views.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the tribalism point is something that we can go on and on about. I think it's hard to underestimate just how polarizing the last 5 to 10 years have been. You can probably go all the way back to essentially the collapse of the last great coalition in British politics, which was the New Labour, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown coalition that brought together somehow. It brought together the likes of Tony Benn and Tony Blair into the same political party. And it was an effective coalition. It brought together the communities of North Lanarkshire and Sedgefield and Bolsover, but also places like Holborn and all these sort of socialist and socialite areas, if you will. Since that's collapsed, essentially since the financial crisis, I would put it back to, we've slowly been seeing the divergence of what used to be a very close two-party system, as someone messages me on Facebook, I believe. Other service providers are available. But we've seen that divergence from parties that, if you go back to, say, 2001, they were so close that people didn't care who won between Tony Blair and William Hague, even though they were pretty certain Tony Blair would win, to now, or the last election certainly, where you look at Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn, and you haven't seen two more polar opposite leaders going to fight a general election since Margaret Thatcher and Michael Foot, realistically, back in 1983. So this polarization, this lack of, it's not so much a lack of awareness of an opposition, it's a lack of understanding of how they could ever think that way. There are so many Labour voters and Conservative voters who will not even condone the notion of thinking of voting for the other party. There are so many voters on both sides of the political spectrum nowadays who look at people who vote for their hated party and dismiss some of the opinions that they have purely because they voted for the hated party. So I think, Vicky Callum, you're absolutely right. There is this tribal instinct now amongst politics that is so much harder to cut through and make a 1997 style gain. But we also shouldn't be resting, or the Conservative Party rather shouldn't be resting, as you quite rightly pointed out, Vicky, because these two by-election results are bad. By-election or not, in this sort of turnout, yes, the opposition are emboldened during a by-election because it's essentially a free hit to throw all your resources at unseating someone of the governing party. Yes, we know that. We've seen that time after time after time. But it's also a free hit from the governing party to test out their electoral strategy. There's basically nothing else going on. Go for it. Put all your funds into these two campaigns. Make it sell all of your best points. And they've lost big in both of them. So I don't quite know where this leaves the Conservative Party electorally.
I think it's also the combination of the two that's the problem, because it shows two fundamental weaknesses of the Conservative Party. Because it shows that with the newer voters they got in 2019, they haven't maintained that support, and that support is waning, which is so crucial for them to having a kind of majority of any substantial size to get anything controversial through. And it shows them dwindling that support they had with kind of the classic working class Leave voters who voted for them to get Brexit done. But it also shows at the same time, maybe all the efforts they've put into attracting those type of voters in the North has left them really vulnerable in the South with their traditional base voters. And I'm speaking from a place where this is kind of one of those seats that they've got a problem in. people who tend to vote for them for the economy but are starting to get a bit uncomfortable kind of their social positions, the positions of kind of some of the cabinet ministers lying and stuff like that, but also of the position of this, of the idea that they're spending so much time trying to win votes in the north that maybe they're forgetting about traditional seats in the southwest, southeast, and like just anywhere south of London effectively, and that's making them uncomfortable. And the problem with the Conservatives is it's quite hard to win both of those people back, because winning the support of one is kind of conditional on losing the support of the other. And I don't know how they fix that. And that's something that they're going to have to try and think about.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. There's also the point to be made that there was a lot of the Conservatives' focus at the moment is on more national matters, like obviously what is going on in Westminster itself, in sense, like with countless scandals at this point and more seemingly added by the day. Comparatively, I mean, we weren't in the constituency, so we wouldn't be able to say what kind of the on the ground presence of the different parties was, but I would not be surprised certainly if there was more of a presence and a more of a kind of get up and go action from these opposition parties who have taken these seats. We could also talk of course about the idea of there was an element of tactical voting which was attributed to some of these successes, so there is an argument to be made there that it's as much kind of the general sentiment of not, whilst obviously it's great for the parties who have won, it might not have been necessarily that they had a better strategy. It was just that people were so vehemently not wanting it to be the Conservatives, which goes back to that idea of tribalism, which goes back to the idea of taking things for granted, which we've talked about. So it's a very complex bundle of things to analyze, and certainly there's going to be a few, you would hope that there'd be a few people in all of the parties going to the drawing board saying what went well, what didn't, how can we change this for the next by-election or general election.
I want to take that point about sort of the sentiment about anyone but the Conservatives and run with it, because we've seen tactical voting increase, or at least the awareness and therefore the perceived use of tactical voting, just in terms of local versus general election voting, increase year on year and election on election since about 2015, which is the first real ABC block of tactical voting, where we're talking about anyone but the Conservatives rather than tactical voting against the Labour Party, which we saw sort of minimally when New Labour was in power, mainly because there just isn't that same diversity of right-wing political parties in the UK. But looking at tactical voting right now, yes, maybe it is the case that the Conservatives have suffered from that across these two by-elections. But what's to say that tactical voting won't continue into a general election? Now people know it works, because we've seen in Chesham and Amersham, the Labour vote dropped off massively. The Liberal Democrats won the seat. In Joe Cox was and is now Kim Leadbitter. Batley and Spen, the Liberal Democrat vote again tailed off and the Labour Party won the seat. In Tiverton and Honiton, the Labour vote went from second place to barely making their deposit back. Liberal Democrats win the seat. Liberal Democrats didn't even come fifth in Wakefield. Labour win back the seat. We've slowly been proved that tactical voting can oust the Conservatives, despite the fragmentation of the British left and the seemingly rigid uniformity of the British right at the moment, with the electoral death of UKIP and the parliamentary sort of, there was never really born really Reform UK on a parliamentary level. They didn't even get a seat. Even UKIP managed that in by-elections. Reform UK haven't got a seat. And I don't know if they ever will, to be brutally honest, unless they can capitalise on anti-Boris sentiment at the next general election, if they're still a massive enough force. So I wonder if that tactical voting is actually more of a worry than it is a, oh, well, people just voted for to get us out. I wonder if that's a worry that people are willing enough in a general, in a by-election and in successive by-elections to do that for the Conservative Party, more than it is a, oh, well, it's just because they tactically voted and they, it wasn't a big enough election or whatever. I think that could actually be more dangerous, that people have now seen the benefit of it and are taking it and running with it.
I think that should be a massive concern to the Conservatives. And I think you can tell it's a massive concern by the way that they've been kind of attacking this idea of a pact between Labour and Lib Dems, which they've both denied has happened or has happened officially. I mean, they could both see what the news is doing. They could both see where they're doing well and where it's best to focus resources. That isn't necessarily anything suspicious. That's just looking at the news. I also think they'll tax on tactical voting a bit patronising towards voters, because a voter can see which party is most likely to win and therefore where the vote is best placed. But yeah, I think that should be a massive concern for them, because it means the Labour and Lib Dems can focus resources more keenly on seats that they want to win and have more spending power, such more manpower in those areas, and kind of sit back and relax and go, well, the Lib Dems are going to fight that one. Even if there's no official pact or any speaking to each other, they can kind of do that. But also it means they really have to think about fighting to defend seats that they would have taken for granted before. I can only speak for example, but so I'm currently in Guildford. We're a seat which is a Conservative majority, but which has dwindled and dwindled and dwindled, and a seat in which I know the Lib Dems will be really targeting next time, both because of the success they've had in this area in the past, but also because tactical voting has run rife in this place for ages, because I know people who are Labour Party members who would love to vote for the Labour Party, but know the Labour Party aren't going to win, so we'll vote Lib Dem. And that's got a real threat for them in areas like this. And I can only imagine it's the same in lots of their kind of what would have been seen as guaranteed safe seats.
I want to talk about one seat in this area and in the area that we're both actually in, because you're in Guildford. I'm not far away. I'm in Mole Valley. I want to talk about Esher and Walton and the fact that this is Dominic Raab's seat, the Deputy Prime Minister, the Justice Secretary, former Foreign Secretary, of course. And last election, I know for a fact that it was a major target seat for the Liberal Democrats. And there were many Liberal Democrat party members and campaigners who spent a lot of time leafleting there, a seat that essentially the Liberal Democrats should have no hope of winning. At the time, the Foreign Secretary's seat, I mean, an opposition party should never be in a position to take the Foreign Secretary's seat, one of the four great offices of state. It should be just as safe as the Prime Minister's, essentially. It's a succession job for the Prime Minister. And there were a lot of Liberal Democrat Party members and workers who were absolutely pissed off that the Labour Party did not stand down their candidate in Esher and Walton, or at least didn't put forward essentially a paper campaign rather than an actual full-on campaign in Esher and Walton. Because the sentiment is that if the Labour Party had just backed down, Dominic Raab was there for the taking. And the votes very nearly proved that.
I mean, it's the same, it's lesser scale. It's the same thing here in Guildford. So our old Conservative MP, who was Anne Milton, who was kicked out of...
Oh, yeah.
Had
she
to
went independent, removed. Didn't she?
Yeah, she went independent and stood as an independent. She got... Oh, I could get the results up here. She got about 5% of the vote. The Lib Dems lost by 5%.
Yeah.
And I remember because she came to the school, she came to my school when I was there, and I asked her if she felt bad about standing as an independent, considering she thought the Conservatives shouldn't win this seat, and whether she thought maybe she should have let sit down to let the Lib Dems go. And she had a go at me and she said I was being very undemocratic and everyone should have their say. But if you look at the vote total, she won basically 4,300 votes. The Lib Dems were short by about 4,000, 5,000 votes. It would have been so close if she hadn't stood and all of those. And we don't know if all those votes would have gone for the Lib Dems. But, I mean, you just if things had just been slightly more organised, which
wonder,
maybe they are
you?
Now going to be, there yeah. are loads of seats that could be troubled. And it's not just Dominic Raab next time. I think Jacob Rees-Mogg's seat is looking a bit yeah. shaky, as well as Theresa May's, which will be interesting.
Yeah. I mean, just to look at Dominic Raab's seat right now, the results from the 2019 general election in Esher and Walton, for the first time in, I believe, the history of Esher and Walton being a seat. Oh, no, sorry. For the first time since 2005, I beg your pardon, even though that was still 45.7% of the vote. The Conservative vote share in Esher and Walton dropped below 50%. Dominic Raab got 49.4% of the vote. The Liberal Democrats got 45% of the vote. And the Labour Party got 4.5% of the vote. The majority was 2,743 for 77% turnout. The Labour Party got 2,838 votes. So the maths on the left is there to unseat Dominic Raab. Now, the Labour Party will look at that and say, well, hang on a second. Look at the percentage changes. Liberal Democrats went up by a lot. The Labour Party went down by a lot in that particular election. Not all the votes would transfer, but no Green candidate. Obviously, there was that informal, or actually quite formal, pact in progress at the time between the Greens, Plaid Cymru, the Liberal Democrats, to not stand in contesting seats for that general election, which I think we're likely to see again, if I'm being brutally honest, at the next general election, whenever that is. But looking at some of the other seats as well that are high up on the Liberal Democrat target list, if you get a swing anywhere near what happened in Tiverton and Honiton, it's a gold wall rather than a blue wall.
Yeah, and they've created a load of momentum now because people are going, well, there's loads of local Lib Dem parties going, we can do this. We just need to keep going, keep going, keep going. And voters are aware of this. It's only going to push awareness of tactical voting. People are going to go, oh, maybe I should. Because there's always a choice in tactical voting. It's like, oh, if it's going to make a difference, maybe tactical vote. But I also want to vote with my heart. But The clearer it becomes that that could make a difference, and the clearer it comes that maybe you could unseat a cabinet minister, the more people go, maybe I should forget about where my heart is for this one election.
I mean, imagine if you are someone who dislikes the Conservative Party and you have a cabinet minister in your seat. Your constituency, you individually, have a chance to be part of a Portillo moment. This is a thing that we are still talking about. What is it, 25 years on now, from everyone who was politically inclined, who was alive at the time, is thinking, where was I when Michael Portillo lost his seat, when Stephen Twigg got that late call up to become a candidate and just fought the election and unseated, what was he, the defence secretary at the time, someone who was tipped to be the next Conservative Party leader. That has resonance around the political realm. And even if you think, oh, well, I'm a Labour member, I don't particularly like the Liberal Democrats, or I don't really want to vote Green because I don't believe in how they'll run the economy, or whichever way round it goes, having the chance to unseat a cabinet minister, it sounds horribly cynical, but the British party, the British public, sorry, love inflicting schadenfreude on other people. The joy that we, as especially political people, get in watching someone we dislike fail is almost more in a political system that is so adversarial and so tribal, as we've talked about, and it's coming back to this tribal nature, it's almost greater than seeing our party of our hearts win our seat. As long as the party of our hearts doesn't get crushed and does all right and does as expected, we're happy to not vote for them in our own constituency if it means the party we hate and cannot stand gets done over.
Yes, interesting. And just going to quickly go back to the point of Vicky, you mentioned about how local Lib Dem parties are going to be looking at this and saying, okay, this is something great we can do. We also can't probably minimize the fact that this will have on the national kind of sentiments towards the Lib Dems, who frankly all the way up to the 2019 general election have still been trying to get out of the under the shadow of the coalition, essentially, and the fact that they've won this by-election could help people see them as a proper contender moving forwards, as a more genuine kind of option as opposed to just kind of they're there, you know, the candidates who are. So it's very much kind of the fact that this is such a significant win for the Dems is just a really so much of a reminder that the next general election isn't just a two-horse race. It isn't just Conservatives versus Labour, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, I'll agree with you on that. It's not a two-horse race. It is for who's going to form the next government. Obviously, we've all pretty much accepted that it's either going to be Labour-led or Conservative-led. There are many people saying the Lib Dems are going to sweep to a majority or even to the larger party of a coalition.
I think Jo Swinson is. She
is the next person I was just about to reference, because if we're looking at the 2019 general election, that was a catastrophe for the Liberal Democrats. I know that the seats lost was nowhere near the level of 2015 when Nick Clegg's coalition gamble was seen to have massively failed and that principles were traded for power, which is not an unfair accusation to throw, but is also somewhat simplifying something that is very hard to simplify in terms of power politics and party politics. But that's a conversation for a very different podcast. The 2019 general election was an unmitigated failure for the Liberal Democrats. Jo Swinson went into that campaign saying, I am a candidate for Prime Minister, and went out of it with no seat. To think now the Liberal Democrats are being talked about as a party that can seriously mount a threat to the Conservative Party, not necessarily as an alternative party of government, because we've all agreed that's not happening for the short term anyway. Maybe the medium to long term people can dream, but for the short term, off limits. But when you're looking at the swing that the Liberal Democrats got in Tiverton and Honiton, which the actual percentage points escape me at the moment, but I'm just looking down the results and the target seats for the next general election for the Liberal Democrats. And I'm looking at the swing needed. And you've got two seats in the top 25, I believe. Three seats in the top 25 that are not Conservative held. You've got Dumbartonshire East, which was Jo Swinson's seat, 0.14% swing needed. That's from the SNP. Sheffield Hallam and Cambridge, they are both from the Labour Party. One of them needs a 0.63% swing. Cambridge needs an 8.7% swing. But then you've got seats that the Liberal Democrats would never have dreamed of getting. You've got Wimbledon in London, 0.59% swing. Cheltenham, Winchester, Cambridgeshire South, Esher and Walton. Those are all in the top 10 most attainable seats, all under 2.5% swing. Guildford needs just under 3% swing. The cities of London and Westminster needs less than 5% swing. Surrey South West needs 7.3% swing. These are so, so tiny swings to get such critical Conservative seats that, I mean, I would have had no problem calling Esher and Walton, Guildford, Winchester, true blue seats. I would have no problem at all in calling them true blue, and yet they're all within the top 11 most attainable seats for the Liberal Democrats at the next general election. Even looking at Mole Valley, the constituency I'm currently sat in, only requires an 11% swing to go to the Liberal Democrats. And that sounds big in comparison to when we were talking about that 0.59% swing that's needed to go to, which one was it, Wimbledon. But that's less than half of what the swing was in Tiverton and Honiton. So it's no longer inconceivable that these fantastically true blue, dyed-in-the-wool Conservative till I die seats are now under threat. So, Vicky, you're absolutely right. The Conservatives are going to have to spend a lot more money and a lot more time and a heck of a lot more effort shoring up a support base that they will have thought was with them for decades. Hell, even Whitney, David Cameron's old seat, 13% swing will do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways this is a trend that's been going that way for since probably around 2016 and that kind of thing. As an area, we Ains to be more of a main than other parts of the country. But I think it was this kind of shift that was hidden by Jeremy Corbyn, because I think people were changing their minds. Well, I can only speak from Guildford, but the idea was they were changing their minds. They didn't really like the Conservative Party, but the thing stopping them voting Lib Dem was the idea they'd go into a coalition with Corbyn, and that was worse for them. And as long as the Labour Party remains looking fairly centre and moderate, these are seats that are actually, that's going to benefit the Lib Dems, because these are seats that are never going to vote Labour, but are going to vote Lib Dem as long as they can kind of agree with a moderate Labour Party. And I think it's taken the Conservatives far too long to realise that. And there is very much a feeling of these seats are being taken for granted.
One other thing that is probably quite important to mention, but is going well underneath the radar right now, is, well, it's the restructuring of the constituency boundaries. Because that's coming soon. At present, there are no plans to stop the Boundary Commission from making their full report. The secondary consultation has closed as of April 2022, and there will be a full review of these boundaries in 2023, which has already been proposed and is going to take effect in late 2023. So in time for the 2024 general election, if we stick to the Fixed Term Parliaments Act timetable, which most people at the moment, I'm one of them, are saying, okay, it definitely won't be December 2024. We're looking at least summer 2024, possibly even a snap election as soon as anything comes through from Durham Police about Keir Starmer, if anything comes through from Durham Police about Keir Starmer, because Boris Johnson is looking like he's putting the Conservative Party on a snap election footing. Who knows? That's just conjecture, though. I'd love an election. Just not right now. Maybe a September election.
Not in the summer. Not September. We can't deal with a September election.
I'd love one. I'd love one.
We're not starting with election.
It'd be a birthday present.
I'm not even going to be part of the news team properly at that point, and I'm just saying no.
At least October. October, so we can have a bit of warm-up into it.
Yeah, all right. October election, if you're listening, government. But this is the real constituency review that is, it's been very divisive, really. At the moment, the review that I'm looking at from the Electoral Commission is looking at keeping 650 constituencies. However, massive plans for a reduction in the number of constituencies to go down to 600. It was in the Conservatives' 2015 manifesto to bring in a sort of slimming down of the constituencies across the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. It does look like the places where the Conservatives are traditionally strongest are getting the greater benefit, even from this review, because I'm looking at it here. East Midlands, much more conservative than the West Midlands, you'd say. Increase of one. West Midlands, decrease of two. Eastern, so we're looking at East Anglia, sort of Northampton area, anywhere around there. Increase of three. Northeast, Northwest, decrease of four. Southeast and Southwest, increase of 10. Yorkshire and the Humber, no change. London, up two. Scotland goes down two. Wales goes down a couple. Northern Ireland stays the same. Conservatives shoring up their base. Having to reach out less to the red wall, perhaps. Maybe looking like David Cameron wasn't thinking ahead to Boris Johnson's political strategy when he put it in place part of this boundary review to bring down the number of seats. It's very interesting. People aren't really mentioning the boundary review at the moment. It's going under the radar quite rightly as well, because we're still recovering from COVID. We've got massive allegations being levelled at the government. Another one today about a deputy chief whip in the Conservative Party allegedly groping two men and then quitting his post. At the moment, not being forced to leave the Conservative Party or resigning from the Commons, but that's an entirely different argument. But this boundary review could have profound ramifications for every single major party's electoral strategy going forward. I wonder, have I just dropped an entirely useless statistic here, or is this actually something that I've got a point in raising? Please tell me I've got a point.
I mean, I think you've got a point. I mean, I know at least you and me, Reece, we kind of look at American politics, and it's not entirely the same effect things like gerrymandering have in America, this boundary change. And I think we can all, I think because of that, we're kind of built to be very skeptical of any boundary change as being very politically motivated and evil and kind of, but, and I think I probably have more faith in the change happening in the UK as being at least semi-motivated by legitimate reasons. Again, I'm not sure it's going to have a major effect. It could have some effect, but if the Conservatives are hoping at increasing 7 seats in the South East is going to help them, recent developments mean that might not help them. So I don't think it massively favours one party. It just means maybe they have to think a bit about where they put resources.
Yeah, I was going to mention the idea of gerrymandering as well. And frankly, it's just by nature. If there was political motivation behind it, there was... Whilst I'm not going to say every side would do that, it's one of those things where a party in power wants to shore up its ability to hold on to that power. It's a general kind of philosophy in politics, regardless of your kind of leanings. But yeah, it's going to be, I think, certainly compared to the American system, as Vikram was mentioning, there's a lot more scruples when it comes to these sorts of reviews. We're not going to end up with some sort of headphone constituency like they've got in one of the districts over there. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where these kind of new borders and new kind of distributions happen, because that's going to be, more speaking of it, rather than necessarily the absolute number, more how that's going to affect relative kind of areas. Because obviously, if you create a new constituency, but you split the opposition parties even more, that's going to work for you more in the long run. Anyone who knows anything about gerrymandering would know that.
And I mean, I hate to bring it back to Mole Valley, but Callum, you've hit the nail bang on the head. The constituency that I'm currently in, Mole Valley, is set to not exist by the time of the next general election, should the boundary review go through. It's going to turn into, I think it's Holmwood and Bear Green, or Dorkings and Bear. Oh, it's something. It's a different name. And it looks like the current plans that have been laid out on the table are that whilst Mole Valley itself used to have Dorking and Leatherhead, big areas of anti-Tory sentiment, the new constituency, whilst it will keep Dorking, no Leatherhead. That's been carved off somewhere else. So the opposition is being a little bit split in this particular boundary review, just in this one isolated case. I don't know whether that's happening in the opposite direction around and about, but it's just something that doesn't quite sit right. And it's an incredibly local issue for me, given that I live here. But also, it does give me a little bit of uncertainty about, well, hang on. Yeah, I know it's two of the suburban centres being separated, but they're also two of the bigger areas of opposition central focus in this constituency. So I don't know, just to sort of double down on your point there, Callum.
I mean, it's kind of always going to be a problem in our political system. If you want to try and get kind of equal populations in each of the constituencies, and cities tend to be more Labour and rural areas tend to be more Conservative. And if you have too many cities in a constituency or near cities, that's going to be more left wing. And if you try and make the populations more even, then you've got to introduce more rural communities and take away some of the cities, which are going to be more Conservative. And that balancing act is always going to exist. And that's just, I think, probably something we have to live with, and maybe not think evil Machiavellian like tactics, and more how our political system works and which demographics vote for which party.
Yeah, this is entirely possible. This is just entirely by nature of demographics, but it has to be said, this is going to have an effect on the political landscape of the way that people are represented, and in a certain, like, the parity of people's votes as well. I mean, I was going to make something, not so much a joke, but I was going to make a point that the Scots aren't going to be happy that they have two less MPs, certainly with recent discussions, which are going in Scottish politics. So it's going to be interesting to kind of see, again, it's going to be interesting to see how these demographics in different constituencies change. And I think we can't really infer motivation until we do like full analysis of where the new borders are going to be almost.
I also just want to issue a slight correction to something I've previously said, because I'm now reading through some of the amendments to bills that were put through. The Parliamentary Constituencies Act 2020 amended the 1986 Parliamentary Constituencies Act. It scrapped the provision that both Houses of Parliament need to vote on a draft order in council. So this is something put forward by the the Commission, the Electoral Commission, and the Boundaries Commission. It's now just delivered to the Speaker of the House of Commons and sent to the government, who must then draw up a draft order in council containing the final recommendations of the commissions without amendment. So it's purely an apolitical process at the moment. And the Parliamentary Constituencies Act 2020 has negated the 650 to 600 shift. So it's locked the number of constituencies at 650, including five protected constituencies due to their size and or cultural relevance, which includes something like the Anglesey. I cannot pronounce the Scots Gaelic. So it's
stuff like that.
Yeah, the Isle of Wight's one of them. And there's also a Scots Gaelic one, which is like Naha Isle Ebrid. Yeah, it's the Outer Hebrides or something. It's a lot. It's a lot to get your mouth around when you're trying to read it, because there are so many consonants and so many vowels, and it's just, yeah. How is it spelt? Actually, there are two protected constituencies in Scotland. One of them is that one that I can't spell nor pronounce, and the other one is Orkney and Shetland. So it's mainly for islands, which is, yeah, very, very important. The Isle of Wight, you're quite right, Vicky, is protected as a constituency. In fact, it's going to become two protected constituencies as of the new boundary review. That's a lot to get through. Anyway, where were we? Oh, yeah, we started this podcast talking about by-elections, didn't we? So let's talk now about the future of the government in terms of electoral viability. We've talked a lot about many different things, talked about boundary reviews now. Somehow I dragged the conversation onto them. We've talked about 1997. We've talked about all sorts of different possible target seats. But where do each of the main parties go forward now? Let's say that the main parties are the Conservatives, the Labour Party, the SNP, because we have to talk about them. Any talk of elections, especially right at the moment, given what's happening in Scotland, and I'm sure we'll have a separate podcast on that in the not too distant future. The SNP, the Liberal Democrats, and let's add, I'll be very pleased about this, the Green Party to it. I'm very, very sad to leave out Plaid Cymru, but I think for this particular argument, because they are so specifically Welsh, and as was mentioned on a news show, specifically quite regionally Welsh at the moment. They don't have the mass appeal the same way the SNP do in Scotland, that the Plaid Cymru, they don't quite enjoy that yet in Wales. What can those five parties, so Tories, Labour, SNP, Lib Dems, Green, what can they do going forward? And the reason I've put the Greens in there is not necessarily because I'm expecting them to have much of a seat gain, but because their role is seemingly crucial in how well other smaller parties can do, looking at how many votes they might take away from the Liberal Democrats, or how many voters and members potentially they could take away from the Labour Party if the Labour Party gets too centrist for other people's liking. So I don't know who wants to kick that off, because it's a very, very long question/statement.
I mean, we could take it party by party. So Labour need to work out how, well, they need to actually become one party, or seem to be one party, so people could actually be convinced they'd effectively run the government. And I think probably need to work out if they're going to aim for a kind of coalition which they're in the lead, in which case they only kind of need to win the Red Wall seat back and hope the Conservatives just collapse elsewhere, or if they're going to try and become elected, like have a majority, in which case they're going to have to start thinking about Scotland and winning over some other kind of seats where they may be more competition with the Lib Dems. And I think the tactics are going to depend varied on whether they want to try and take it all or go incremental and let the Lib Dems do some of the work for them. For the Lib Dems, I think their tactics are just going to be focused on the Southwest and Southeast and just really go for people being upset about kind of social issues and moral values within the Conservative Party, and hope people are sure enough about the state of the economy or are certain enough that there's not going to be major economic differences between the two parties that they're willing to vote on those issues and go for them. Greens, I think it's probably in their best interest to keep in a pact with the Lib Dems, because at least that means they're guaranteed some seats where they're going to have little opposition from Lib Dems and maybe even Labour, because if the Labour are being clever about it. And then the Conservatives, who knows, because they've got many fires in different areas they need to put out, and it's not clear what the strategy out of that is.
I mean, I just entirely agree with that assessment. Honestly, it's going to be a challenge for, there's no party which has come out smelling of roses. There's no party which can think of this election as a sure thing, any results in this election as a sure thing, I would say. But yeah, certainly for the Conservatives, they're going to need to look at their kind of on the ground efforts, try to get the conversation more local, more kind of less focused on the ongoing national scandals, and try to avoid adding any more to the ever expanding list. Labour wise, they have to shore up their backbone of the voters, because obviously, as I alluded to earlier, they've been having a few issues with the trade unions lately. So it's not as much a constituency specific thing, but certainly demographically, they need to make sure that they are putting their message towards the right, towards a distinct group of people, and that is one message almost as a party, because the fragmentation of the party only leads to people not being confident that their views are going to be expressed properly. Lib Dems, they need to definitely take the win and use it as their kind of, as part of their national strategy, and say that, look, we have been able to we've been able to already take a chunk out of the Conservative majority, and you know, you can help us do the same. And they still need to be looking at those opportunities to make pacts and work with the other more progressive parties like the Greens, essentially. And I would entirely agree with the assessment of the Green Party situation, where the only way that they are definitely getting a confirmed number of seats is if they work with parties like Lib Dems, like Plaid Cymru, and just shore up the left-wing vote, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, you're both making very good points in terms of how the party should be going about this thing that is the next general election campaign, whenever that may be. We have absolutely no idea. See, we know our preference is October, but that's about as far as we can get. The Conservative Party and the Labour Party actually have quite a similar issue. They just have to come at it from very different angles. The Conservative Party have a much harder time of completing their task, because they have to maintain the broad coalition, give or take, built around Brexit that got them into power in 2019 with a massive majority. Biggest majority we'd seen since Tony Blair. Biggest Tory majority since Margaret Thatcher. Massive. Really impressive win, politically speaking, for the Conservative Party. As you said, quite rightly, Callum, they are putting out fires left, right and centre. And I mean that literally. They are putting out fires left, right and centre of their political spectrum. A lot of them, they do seem to be starting themselves as well, which you cannot do. A divided party does not win a general election. We saw it with the Labour Party in 2019. We saw it with the Labour Party in 2015. I hate to say it again. We saw it with the Labour Party in 2010. We saw it with the Conservative Party for most of the years under New Labour. And we saw it with the Labour Party most of the years under Thatcher. They need to be united. Otherwise, the government will start ripping itself apart and parties can't vote for that. Voters can't vote for that. The Labour Party has almost the other side of the coin. They have to put together, they have to put back together a winning coalition. They know how to do it. They've done it before. Keir Starmer seems intent on leading them down a similar style of coalition application that Tony Blair did. I'm not saying he's doing what Tony Blair did. All I'm saying is he's going about it in a similar way. It's shore up the Labour base and then attack the Conservatives base. It's not go after traditional swing left-wing seats to take it off the SNP or to take it off the Liberal Democrats. It's take things off the Conservatives. Win Middle England, win number 10. Sorted. Liberal Democrats, it's pretty clear what they have to do. It's the only thing they can do. Work from the base and expand out. Use that hub of strength that they've got in areas now like Chesham and Amersham after a big win, Tiverton and Harleton after a big win. Go from the seats they've managed to keep all the way through since the disaster of 2015, the disaster of 2019. The seats they've had there, expand from there. Shore up where they are good. Shore up where they are confident. Keep those areas. Keep saying the messages that work and the seats will follow. Either that or the Lib Dems are a completely spent force in British politics and they should give up and go home now while everyone still has a bit of goodwill towards them and let someone else take their place as the centre left or the centre ground, perhaps. And the Green Party, they are critical to the minor left-wing debate. If they stand everywhere, they will take small numbers of votes away from the Labour Party in some seats, large numbers of votes away from the Labour Party in other seats, and a good proportion of almost a left-wing protest vote away from the Liberal Democrats. And that might be in their interest as a political party, but as a political party with the ideas they want to be put forward into the way the nation goes, I think it's more in their interest to play this tactically. The one party that we haven't mentioned yet, the SNP, well, the next election is going to be absolutely critical for them because they will either never have to fight it because they'll be independent, which I'm going to put it out here and now, it's not going to happen before the next general election. Or it's going to be a one-line manifesto, because that's exactly what Nicola Sturgeon said she'd do. And I have no reason to think she wouldn't keep that particular promise to fight on a one-line manifesto. And it will be existential for the SNP. Because if people want it, they'll vote for it. And if they don't want it, well, the Green Party are a nationalist party. They can vote for them if they want a left-wing party in Scotland that will stand up for Scottish independence, but also has other policies. And if they aren't really that fussed about independence, well, then there are plenty of left and centre-right parties in Scotland standing who will be standing on far more than one policy. So it's a big election for all of those parties. It's going to be a massive election for every single political party, but those especially. And I just wonder how it is going to go. And I mean, it all hangs in the balance, realistically. These by-elections have taught us a lot, but have also told us very little about how a general election will go, because as everyone quite rightly said at the start, turnout is so far down, which can either mean everything or nothing. I wonder if anyone's got any sort of parting thoughts they want to give on either the by-elections, the state of politics, or anything you want to chip in on about sort of British politics and elections coming up.
I mean, I suppose my caveat is everything we've just said can be completely irrelevant if the leaders of both the two major parties have changed by the time of the next election, which is entirely possible, in which case we have to completely rethink about the image of those two leaders in particular, the direction they're going to take their parties in, and that's going to completely change their strategies.
Yeah, and also I think one of the main factors on how the next election is going to go is going to be when it is. So obviously you've mentioned how Boris Johnson seems to be moving the Conservative Party onto a snap election footing. It's going to be whether these ongoing issues, whether the ongoing scandals are still in that public consciousness. That is going to be a massive factor in how these elections go, both for the two main parties as well as the other opposition parties.
So after just over an hour of talking about these issues, we've worked out that anyone who tries to tell you absolutely anything about how they predict the next general election is going to go is either lying, stupid, or both. So with that being said, thank you very much for listening to what we've had to say about how we think the next general election is going to go and what these by-elections mean for everyone involved in it. I'd like to thank Vicky and Callum for coming on. It's great to have you, and I'm certain we will have you back in the future. Or if you don't want to turn up, it's a very cold-hearted way of telling me, but you're always welcome back on. And I can't wait to see what we are talking about next time. Thank you to everyone who has been listening, and we will be back with another Election Watch in the not too distant future. I look forward to seeing you all again there for that one. Goodbye.